I have two questions tonight, and I have a question that was sent to me a bit ago, so I've had some time to consider it. And then I have a second question that came to me at 3 o'clock this afternoon, so I really didn't have much time to consider that one. However, that particular question I want to put first, because, and I mean no disrespect to the person who gave me the question, all right? Please understand, I mean no disrespect. But I'm going to come off looking like Scrooge in this question, okay? And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to answer this question first, and then hopefully my answer to the second question will get the taste out of your mouth of the first one, okay? Now, it's a perfectly legitimate question that's asked, and the question is based on the fact that I have said in the past that I think that there are certain things about Christmas that we get wrong. Myths, if you will, that have grown up around this holiday. And the particular person who asked the question asked me, okay, what are some of these myths that have grown up? Okay, so I haven't had a chance to do a great deal of research on this topic, so I'm going to give very short, quick answers from my recollections. And I imagine there's much more that could be said and much more detail that could be provided, but I thought I would just start with a few things that are, in a sense, mythological about this holiday that we celebrate. Okay, the first one, of course, and the obvious one that comes to mind right away is the date. We celebrate Christmas, the birth of Christ, on December the 25th, but it is very unlikely that Jesus was born on December the 25th. It is much more likely that Jesus was born during a time of the year where shepherds were able to leave their flocks in a field and go into Bethlehem and see the child, in which they would have felt comfortable with leaving sheep out. So that would not be likely to be in the wintertime, which in the Northern Hemisphere, December sits in the middle of winter, or at least at the beginning of winter, and it's turned cold. So it's highly unlikely it's in December. I think that the scholars that I have read through time have a tendency to put this either in the spring or in the fall. There's some possibility it could be in the fall during the early sheep shearing season for the one-year-old lamb. Some have suggested that. Some have suggested the spring because Caesar Augustus's decree that went out in Luke 2 appears to be dated in the early part of the of six roughly 6 BC. I'll get to that in a second. So we don't really know when it was, but it's highly unlikely it was December 25th. There is some evidence that Constantine celebrated Christmas for the first time in the late 300s on December the 25th, and it became stuck there. We know that Pope Julius I proclaimed December 25th in the Catholic Church to be the official date of Christmas. And I forgot to look up the dates of Pope Julius I, but anyways. So somewhere in the medieval period, the Catholic Church pronounced that to be the date. Again, is it really relevant whether it's December 25th or someplace else? Probably not, because the point is to celebrate the birth rather than the particular date. Okay. So in terms of date or season, I would think that's one of the first things that is, in a sense, mythological. We look at manger scenes, and what do we see? We see wooden buildings with a wooden stable, but archaeologically, we know that Bethlehem sat near a range of low mountains. It's highly likely that Jesus was actually born in a cave, which would have been used as a stable, with a creche cut out of the side of the rock, would have been used to put the hay in for the animals. Now, again, it's certainly possible that it was a physical building, but physical buildings housing animals would have been extremely rare. Only the very rich would have that sort of thing, and it's highly unlikely that Mary and Joseph would have wound up in the stable of a very rich man, giving birth to the child. Kind of negates the whole idea of what's going on with Jesus being born there, right? So it's possible, but it's probably not the image that you see when you see a manger scene. You know, it's a nice little wooden building, a little Jesus and a little trough, you know, that sort of thing. It's probably not the picture of it. Additionally, the inn We think of, I don't know what you conjure up in your mind about the inn, but what I conjure up in my mind at a time is sort of like this big building full of people, and there's an innkeeper, and there's lots of rooms there, and everybody's there, and there's no room at the inn. But that's probably not what the inn would have been. It's more likely the inn would simply been somebody's home that would have been open for travelers, an Airbnb of Bethlehem, if you will, that would have been there. Remember, Bethlehem is just a small village, so it's certainly not going to be a place where you're going to find a Holiday Inn, right? It's going to be a place very low key, just homes, just people's houses. And so the inn is probably just a home, and the innkeeper is probably just the man that owned the home that lived there, more than likely, who had guests, probably family that had come to Bethlehem for the very purpose of which Mary and Joseph had gone there for the registration. So all of the little Airbnbs in town would have been filled up. And so Mary and Joseph arriving there would have had to find something else. And we know that they were poor. They were not rich. And so they would not have been able to afford even a hotel, quote unquote, if such a thing would have been there. So even the inn itself is a bit of an anachronism. Probably the most significant mythological element of the whole birth scene is the Magi. I've spoken of this before. The title "We Three Kings of Orient Are" is wrong in every word. Okay. Well, first of all, they're not kings. They're priests. They're Persian priests. They're coming from Persia to the east, bringing their paganisms, although it is very possible that they were, in fact, Persian pagan priests who were also Yahweh worshippers. It's very possible that they were. Thus, and the reason why is because they knew of the foretelling of the star that guided them to Bethlehem, and they knew to go looking for the child, and so they were undoubtedly familiar with the Jewish scriptures. The Septuagint was probably well published and distributed by that point. So it's very possible that these pagan priests came as Yahweh worshippers. They were not kings, they were priests. And there wasn't three of them. Now, we think of three because there's three gifts given, right? Gold, frankincense, and myrrh. But that's probably mythological too. It is undoubtedly a caravan of these priests that would have come to Bethlehem looking for this star. So they would have come as a group of priests. And if you really want to get technical about it, Persia is not in the Orient. Okay, the Orient really exists beyond the Indus River, which would be beyond Persia into India. That's technically the Orient. So, yeah, okay, we'll call it the far Middle East, and it's almost to the Orient. So, okay, so we're kind of close there. But it's they're not three Japanese priests, okay? They're not three Japanese princes or kings from the Orient, as we consider the Orient. Now, I realize the Middle East is often lumped in with the Orient, but it's geographically separate and very distinct from the Far East, okay? In fact, that's why we call it the Middle East, because it is distinct from the Far East, which begins the Indus River. So they would have, these Magi would have come. And when they arrived, is highly unlikely to be the night of Jesus' birth. Highly unlikely. And the reason why is there's evidence in the Gospel of Matthew, the only gospel that records their appearance, that they came, and when they came into the house. The indication being that Jesus and his family had moved into a house there in Bethlehem. The most likely outcome of all of this is that although Joseph and Mary was from Nazareth, they must have decided to settle in Bethlehem after the child was born. We are not given a reason why. It could be simply in the providence of God that he purposed for them to be there in order that the Magi would come to that place and look for them. So Joseph and Mary do not return to Nazareth, but apparently settle in that place. And it says that the Magi come into the house to offer their gifts. So it's more than likely that Jesus is already a toddler at the point that the Magi come. Another evidence of that is the fact that Herod kills all of the children under two. If, in fact, the child was just a newborn, Herod overplayed his hand significantly there. He would have had a need to do that. So more than likely, given what he ascertains from his intellectual advisors who tell him about the appearance of the star and when it's appeared, he deduces that at this point the child must be roughly 2 years old, give or take. And so he decides to kill all the children under two. That's another evidence that the Magi were not there on that particular night. Okay, so again, take your little manger scene that you have with the thing. Okay, throw the wise men out of it. Okay, all right, that's number one. And then throw the manger, the whole thing itself away, and build a cave and put Jesus in there. And you're going to get a lot closer to what the picture of that night would have looked like. All right. One additional mythology that I'll pass is, and I say this carefully, this is not a virginal birth, okay? Jesus's reality is a virginal conception. 9 months earlier is what matters in terms of the virginity of Mary. Now, true, Mary was still a virgin at the time that Jesus was born, because the Gospel of Matthew tells us that Joseph did not have relations with her until the child was born, which also implies, by the way, that he did after that, which would have produced additional children to Joseph's family, okay, to Jesus, as Jesus' brothers and sisters. But it's not a virginal birth. It's a virginal conception. It's a birth of a virgin, of a child. But we need to be careful that we understand that the virginal aspect has to do with how he was conceived, not how he was born. His birth was ordinary. Kind of what Dre is supposedly experiencing right about now, right? Just an ordinary birth of a child. That's what Mary would have experienced, the ordinary birth of a child. And so its virginal reality isn't that important. The conception, however, is where the Son of God and the Son of Man unite to become as one. Okay? That's something to consider. Okay. I would say also that probably the greatest mythology, and I'll end with this, I think probably the greatest mythology surrounding Christmas, of course, is the fact that we often celebrate it for exactly the wrong reasons. We like to think of Christmas as the most significant gift that God ever gave. Nothing wrong with that, per se, because it's true. But what's the gift? It's not the giving of the gift that matters. It's the content of the gift that matters. And the content of the gift is God with us. Christmas for Christians is a celebration of God entering into his own creation. Christmas is a celebration of God, the eternal God, the infinite God, the omniscient one, the omnipotent one, robing himself in flesh and entering into this world, coming to reveal to us the fullness of the Godhead in Christ Jesus. That's the point. The point isn't the fact that we were given a gift. It's true. Jesus becomes a gift in the sense that, yes, it is his birth that makes it possible for us to be saved by Christ himself going to the cross. But we celebrate Christmas specifically because it's the incarnation that we're celebrating. Okay. Now, you will notice that in our culture, it's all about the gift-giving aspect of it. Okay, and even the mythology of Santa Claus and Christmas trees and all that other stuff that is the deep cultural mythologies that go with it, all of that is centering itself around that particular aspect. But if you ask the typical unregenerate, non-believing man why he celebrates Christmas, the last answer he's going to give you is because God came into his world. That's not going to be the answer. The answer he's going to give you is, well, if he has any sense at all of who God is, he'll say, well, God gave us a great gift of Jesus. But what does that mean exactly? Okay. And that's the point. We celebrate Christmas because it is a celebration of the coming of Christ, the coming of God. Or as we've said numerous times now, right, John, the monogenes one that has come into the world, the only begotten of the Father, a unique one, one unlike any other that has come. That's what makes Christmas so very interesting. So I imagine there's other mythologies that we could talk about and other kinds of things, but my point in answering the question is that, okay, let's keep the focus where it needs to be in the course of the season, okay?
December 8th is Holy Catholic Church celebrates the Immaculate Conception.
But it ain't the conception of Jesus.
It was that fact that she was sinless.
Right. Her conception. Her conception is being celebrated. It's not Jesus' conception. No. Yeah. Okay, so with that in mind, then, I want you to take your Bible or your Bible app and open it to Matthew chapter 18. I received a question, as I said earlier, and if there's a question that I could receive that would end this time of Ask the Pastor, this would be the one that I would want, okay? Because this particular question has all of the various facets of the kinds of things that I've been trying to communicate with you through this Ask the Pastor. It has hermeneutical implications, it has exegetical implications, it has historical implications, it has expository, dare I say, applicable ramifications. It has soteriological ramifications. It has all kinds of ramifications of all the kinds of things that we've been trying to do, whether we take out a Bible passage and try to figure out what it says, or we talk about something in history, or we address some particular doctrinal issue or whatever. Okay, this one has it all. All right? This one has it all. So to the person who sent me this question, and I'm not going to tell you who it is, but the person who sent me this question, I am deeply grateful because this is the question I want to go out on. Okay? This is the question I want to go out on. So I am going to use the rest of my time tonight to finish this question. And if you have questions that you've come tonight with just the perfect stump the pastor question, well, you'll have to stump me by email. All right. Now, the question itself, that as I received it, is fairly lengthy. And so I'm not going to read all of what was sent to me. But I want you to look at a parable that Jesus teaches in Matthew 18, starting in verse 21. And this particular parable, I need to start with noting something. Okay, so let me ask the substantive, let me tell you what the substantive part of the question is, and then we'll work our way through it. And the substantive question is this. In this parable, at the beginning of the parable, a man is forgiven an immense debt, a debt he cannot pay. At the end of the parable, Jesus says that the man's debt was, the man's forgiveness was rescinded. And Jesus himself says at the end of it, verse 34, and in anger his master delivered him to the jailers until he should pay all his debt. So also my heavenly Father will do to every one of you if you do not forgive your brother from the heart. And the question that arose then from that last verse is, can this passage be teaching that once God has granted forgiveness of our sin, an immensely large debt, he can then revoke that forgiveness if we have failed to forgive our fellow servants? Because it seems to me that's what Jesus says. Okay? So let's examine that to see if that's really true. Now, let me start with some basic hermeneutical point, a basic hermeneutical point that we need to consider when it comes to parables. Jesus told parables, but he did not intend them to be allegories. You know what an allegory is, right? An allegory is a story in which each of the details in the story is designed to correspond to something in reality. Okay? Narnia is an allegory. C.S. Lewis wrote that specifically for the purpose of it being an allegory, where the various elements in the story correspond to actual things in time and space. Parables are not allegories. They're not intended to be allegories. The biggest mistake that people make when it comes to parables, in fact, is to assume that every detail in the parable has some particular significance. And we should read the parable looking for all the significances, plural, that we can find in that parable. But that's not the intention of parables. The intention of parables is to make one single point. One single point. Every parable when you read a parable, you should be asking yourself, what's the single point that Jesus is trying to make in this parable? Why is he telling this story? What is he trying to communicate with that parable? Now, that doesn't mean there can't be sub-points, but those sub-points are never more important than the original, and they should never really be what we build our theology around. We must be very careful that we do not take sub-points out of parables and make theology out of them, okay? Which, frankly, is what the question here is doing, in my opinion, okay? So this parable is, like all parables, designed to make a singular point. Now, let me prove that to you by taking you to Matthew 13. Okay, so go back earlier in the book, and you remember that Jesus tells the parable of the sower. Okay, he calls it that, in fact, the parable of the sower. He tells a parable, and the people around him ask him, why are you speaking in parables, right? Verse 10. And he gives a fairly lengthy answer, but his answer is basically this. I'm telling you stories that have points that unregenerate men will not understand. Only those who have been born again by the Spirit of God, only those who belong to me, or more specifically, only those that belong to the kingdom, will understand. Okay, so he's being obtuse on purpose in using parables. He is preaching these stories, telling these stories for the specific purpose of making a parable. I mean, think about it. Even the parable of the sower, sometimes called the parable of the sower and the seed, has a specific point. What's its point? Its point is that only those whose hearts are ready will receive the message. Notice where Jesus tells the parable. He tells that parable inside of this time of asking, of the people asking, why do you speak in parables? I speak in parables because I want my own to understand something. I don't want the rest of the world to understand them. I'm hiding these truths from the rest of the world, but I want my disciples to understand them. That's the point of this parable. Only those who have a heart ready to understand these things will understand them. That's the point of the parable. Okay, so parables are designed to have a singular point. Now, the question you have to ask yourself then is, all right, how do you figure out what the point is? Well, good exegetical approach to a parable is to read it in context. Okay, the context will tell you what the point is. And this is one of those parables that actually has a gorgeous little context to it, because Jesus tells this parable in response to a question that asked them. Okay, so now back to Matthew 18. Now let me just rewind briefly and tell you what's going on prior to this. Jesus, up in verse 15 of the chapter, says, if your brother sins against you, go and tell him his fault between you and him alone. If he listens to you, you've gained your brother. But if he does not listen, take one or two others. And we often point to this little passage and say, that's how church discipline is supposed to take place, right? If your brother sins against you, go and confront him. If that doesn't work, bring some witnesses. If that doesn't work, bring it to the church. Okay. So the context here is this issue of interpersonal relationships amongst brothers, fellow believers. Which, by the way, is why Jesus tells a parable, because he wants to explain it to his own disciples. He doesn't care if everybody else gets it. He cares if his own disciples get it. Okay, so Peter, our little impetuous friend, listens to Jesus speak this way, and he says to Jesus, Lord, how often will my brother sin against me and I forgive him? It's a really badly worded sentence. It really should be, Lord, how many times am I supposed to forgive my brother if he sins against me? Okay, that's a better way to write that. How many times am I supposed to do this? Now, notice what he says next. Seven times? As many as seven times? Okay, so let's stop and think about what Peter's asking here. If your brother sins against you and you forgive him, the first time that you forgive him, do you do it out of obligation or you do it because you want to? You probably do it because you want to, right? Okay, the first time, okay, I'll forgive you. But if your brother comes to you a second time with the same sin, and ask your forgiveness. Now it starts to get a little more difficult, doesn't it? It becomes a little bit more obligatory. All right, I'll forgive you. You did this to me already. Why are you... Okay, I'll forgive you again. What happens when you get to the third time? Well, most of you probably live in the three strikes and you're out world, okay? And so, three times, all right. Now, at this point, I'm getting, you know, pretty much like, forget it. So, Peter thinks he's being really magnanimous by saying, seven times? It's kind of like Peter saying, I mean, look at how special I'm going to be if I forgive my brother seven times. But what he's really saying is this. What he's really saying is that what it's going to be like to be your disciple, that I'm going to have to forgive seven times? Because that's really going to be hard. I mean, that is really going to be difficult to do. The law, by the way, if you didn't know this, it doesn't matter. The law prescribed three times. So Peter thought he was really being magnanimous. What he's really saying to Jesus is, okay, let's talk about this forgiveness thing. You say we're supposed to be forgiving one another. Fine. How many times am I supposed to do that? Seven sounds like a nice round, you know, divine number. Let's use that. And what does Jesus say to him? Jesus says to him, I do not say to you seven times, but 77 times. And that word 77 there, by the way, 77 times is a very complex Greek word, okay? It can be translated as 70 times, or it can be translated as 70 multiples. In fact, I think that's probably how Jesus really intended to say it. 70 multiples of seven. So 490 times. Okay, so if you think seven is rough, and you think 77 is rough, okay, imagine 11 times that, or seven times that, right? Okay. Jesus looks at Peter and says, you are missing the point. You are missing the point. And he uses a parable to explain what the point is. Okay. Now, I think you're familiar with this parable, right? I don't have to read it all. I'll just kind of paraphrase it for you. Jesus tells a parable. Well, no, actually, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to read the first part of it because there's a hermeneutic, an exegetical point that I need to make here. Verse 23. Now, listen to me carefully when I read this, okay? I want you to listen critically to what I'm about to read. Therefore, the kingdom of heaven may be compared to a king who wished to settle accounts with his servants. Did you hear what I just said? The kingdom of heaven may be compared to a king who wished to settle accounts. Now, let me just, right off the bat, let me just make sure that I hammer home an exegetical point. Listen, my friends. Brothers and sisters, when you are reading the Bible, read what it actually says. Okay? The implication of this parable, as you read this parable, you go, okay, I look at the parable. Okay, the king is God, and the other people are us as sinners, right? And Jesus says that the king, God, forgives us, and then we're supposed to go out and forgive others. Okay? What's the assumption? That Jesus is actually making the king out to be God. But that's not what the verse says. That's not what Jesus says, is it? He says the kingdom of heaven may be compared to a king. He doesn't say God may be compared to a king. No, he says the kingdom of heaven may be compared to a king. That, by the way, is an important exegetical point. Read what the Bible actually says. Okay? So, I would suggest to you that the question that's being asked here starts with a fundamental flaw. The fundamental flaw is, oh, the guy that did all the forgiving is God. And so God rescinds at the end his mercy, but that's not what Jesus says. He says the kingdom of heaven is like a king. Okay? Now that's an important point, and you'll see how that fleshes out as we go exegetically through the parable. All right? Now, you know the rest of the parable, I'll just paraphrase from this point. Okay, so there's a king, and he calls in front of him. I'm going to do it again. I'm going to read. No paraphrasing. Okay. Therefore, the kingdom of heaven may be compared to a king who wished to settle accounts with his servants. When he began to settle, one was brought to him who owed him 10,000 talents. Now, what is that word, servants? Anybody remember the Greek word? The word is doulos. Very good. Very Luke. Luke gets a star tonight. Doulos. What does that word mean? Slave. The ESV translators were chicken, okay? They wanted to avoid all kinds of modern problems with the word slavery by using simple words like servant and bondservant and things like that. This man is a slave. Now, in the Roman Empire in those days, as you know, there were several different kinds of slavery. There was chattel slavery. Yes, there were times when the Romans would conquer people and turn the people into chattel slaves. But there was also a lot of slavery in the kind that Jesus himself describes in this parable, where a man is a slave to another because of an economic debt. He owes a debt he cannot pay. He puts himself, therefore, under the slavery or the bond servant nature to a man to pay the debt off. Very often this would be the case. A man would get himself in over his head, or a famine would come and he couldn't afford to buy food, and so he'd put himself under slavery to somebody else who could take care of his needs, and he would work it off with all of his economic gain going to his master until he was free of the debt. Okay? So here's a man who is clearly in debt, and the debt, as you can see, is more than the man could pay in a lifetime. It cannot be paid. There's no way to know how this man wound up with this kind of debt. And remember, the details don't matter. Okay? So don't be sitting, wow, why would Jesus? No, it's just a point. Okay? The man owes a debt beyond anything he can comprehend. And he throws himself down before this king who has ordered him to pay it off now, and he can't. So he throws himself in front of the master, begging for mercy. What he wants is mercy. He wants to receive mercy. It doesn't use the word mercy, but that's obviously what's being said. Have mercy on me. You have to forgive me of this debt. Obviously, the parable is about forgiveness, right? So it's clearly about mercy. So the king forgives the debt. Just lets it go. Question. What happens to the status of the man? He's freed. Is he a slave anymore? No, he's not. Technically, if the debt's been freed, he's not a slave anymore. As a parenthesis, insert into your thought right here the fact that Jesus continues to call him a doulos. Okay? Hold that thought. So the man goes out now that he has received this massive mercy, and he finds another slave who owes him a few bucks, right? The numbers don't matter. It's obviously a tiny debt as compared to the original debt. Now this man, the second slave, is probably not a slave of the first. It's simply another slave, but it doesn't really matter. The point being that here's a man who owes him something, and so this man, the first man, that is, demands payment. And when the second servant cannot give payment, he enslaves him. See it? What does he do to him? Jesus says he throws him in jail and demands that he pay. He puts him in enslavement. He does exactly what had happened to him when he was enslaved for his bondage. He does exactly that. Now, I bring that to your, because that's important to think about here. You know, Jesus is going to make the point. Jesus is making a point here that I'm getting to eventually. Okay. So he enslaves this second man. And word gets back to the king of what has taken place here. And the king is angry about what has happened. So what does the king do? He enslaves him again. He puts him back into his slavery. It's what he says. He says, "You wicked servant, I forgave you everything. And should you not have had mercy on your fellow servant as I had mercy on you?" And in anger, his master delivered him over to the jailers until he should pay all his debt. He enslaves him again. He puts him back into slavery. Now, I'm going to go ahead and spring my trap here. Okay, or I'm going to spring my point. The man never changed status. He never became anything different. And that's why I think Jesus actually calls him a servant through the rest of the parable after he's freed. You'll notice it says in verse 23, verse 28, "But when that same servant, that same doulos, went out, he found one of his fellow doulos who owed him." I think Jesus continues to use the word slave here to make his point that the man never actually got it. And thus, his status never actually changed. He was once a slave, always a slave. Now, let's take this back to what Peter asks. Peter says, "How often should I forgive my brother?" And Jesus is telling a parable to say this to Peter. Listen, it's not about how often or how well you forgive. It's about what you are by nature that matters. It's not how often or how well you forgive. It's about what you are. Let me help you to understand my point. Matthew chapters 5 through 7 are commonly referred to as the Sermon on the Mount. The Sermon on the Mount is often portrayed by many as a sermon on how to live. Liberals love the Sermon on the Mount. I don't know if you know this or not, but liberals love the Sermon on the Mount. They preach the Sermon on the Mount as a way of saying, this is how Christians ought to live. You know, don't commit adultery, don't murder each other, be kind to each other, these sorts of things. Okay. But I tell you, that's me, I tell you, that the Sermon on the Mount is not a sermon on what it means to live out the Christian life. The Sermon on the Mount is what it means to be a part of the kingdom of heaven. What it means to be a part of the kingdom of heaven. You want me to prove it to you? What starts the Sermon on the Mount? What are the first teachings of Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount? You should know that. That's going to be on the final. Come on, what's the first teaching of Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount? All of you have been in churches all your life. You know, don't look it up. The Beatitudes. There you go. The Beatitudes, right? Blessed are the... All right, now, Jesus opens his mouth and taught them, saying, this is 5:3, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." This isn't a diatribe of how to live in the kingdom. The Beatitudes, in fact, are a series of steps into the kingdom. Okay, a little history here. Remember a couple of weeks ago I told you, I think it was in a sermon, I told you the very first sermon that I ever heard was a sermon from from John chapter 17. A guest preacher was at the church, the little Baptist church that I went to, the very week after I was converted. Okay, so I heard a message in John 17. Stuck with me, has stuck with me. I have several illustrations from that sermon that I use all the time, like the dozen pianos in a circle, how you tune them. Okay. But the second sermon that I heard was a sermon from Matthew chapter 5, verse 8. Blessed are the poor, blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. The pastor was doing a series through the Beatitudes that he had named Steps into the Kingdom. This is how you get in. All right? Look at the Beatitudes and you'll see that I'm right. And he was right. So this is like 40-year-old information, right? Blessed are the poor in spirit. The poor in what? The poor in spirit. Those who recognize that they are bankrupt spiritually. What's the first step into the kingdom of heaven? You got to understand what you really are spiritually. Secondly, blessed are those who mourn. What are they mourning over? The fact that they're bankrupt spiritually. What does it take to get into the kingdom of heaven? You got to know you're bankrupt spiritually and you got to mourn over that reality. Third, blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. The meek, not those who go and take it by force or by religion, but who take it by humility, who come before God humbly and say, look, I'm a bankrupt sinner. I got nothing. Number four, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. What do they come seeking? What do they come looking for? They come looking for righteousness. They come looking for what they don't have as they mourn over the fact that they are spiritually bankrupt. Now number five, blessed are the merciful, for they will receive mercy. Now, how many of you think Jesus said that backwards? Wait. Are you suggesting to me, and my interlocutor and this question is hinting at this, right? Are you suggesting to me that I have to be merciful in order to receive the mercy of God? And if I'm not merciful, that I don't get the mercy of God, or he withdraws the mercy of God? Is that what's being said? Is that what Jesus is saying? No. Why? How do we know? Because these are people who mourn over their spiritual bankruptcy, who have come meekly before God, hungry and thirsting for righteousness. What do they have? Zippity-doo-dah. This statement is a statement which helps explain the parable which has to do with mercy that we've been working on. Those who receive mercy are merciful by nature. Those who are merciful are only merciful towards others because that is their new nature. It's what they are. And what they do. What they are. Don't believe me? Still don't believe me? 1 John. Can you love God without Him loving you first? Let me see if I can quote this correctly. Not that we loved God, but that He loved us and sent His Son to be the propitiation for our... We don't love God first. He loves us first. But what is John's point in 1 John 4? If you have been loved by God, then you are, by nature, a person who loves. Still don't believe me? James. Justified by faith, or justified by faith that shows itself in your existence and in your life. Can you just say that you have faith? No, it must demonstrate itself. In other words, the person who is truly trusting in God demonstrates he's trusting in God by the things that he does. The person who's been loved by God loves because the love of God is in him. The person who is merciful because the mercy of God has been demonstrated to him. In other words, the entirety of the parable in John 18 is simply saying this. Peter, it's not about how well you forgive or how often you forgive. It's about whether you have been changed into a person of mercy. The man who received the mercy and then was re-enslaved, quote unquote, although I think he was still a slave, his nature was never changed. And he was never a part of the kingdom of heaven in the first place. Remember what Jesus said at the beginning of the parable? The kingdom of heaven is like a king who gives mercy. And the rest of the parable is, let me tell you what the kingdom is like. Let me tell you what people in the kingdom are like. They're going to be people who understand mercy. Why? Because their natures have been changed to be people who are themselves merciful. The man was never merciful. He was always a slave. He never became anything but that. This isn't about God the Father pouring out some sort of mercy upon the guy and the guy not going out and doing what he's supposed to do. That's exactly the point that Jesus is trying to belie in Peter. Because Peter is simply trying to say, hey Lord, in the kingdom, if we forgive seven times, is that going to be sufficient? Is that what you're going to want? And Jesus is going to say, you've missed the point, Peter. You've missed the point. The point is, in the kingdom, it's not about how often or how well you forgive. It's about what it means to be a person of mercy. Look, I give you permission to chisel the word ontology onto my gravestone, okay? Because if I can get one point across to the few people who will listen to me before I die, here's what I want to say to you. Listen, it's not about what you do. It's about who you are. It's always about who you are. It's never been about what you do. Peter thought it was about what you do and how often you do it and how magnanimous you are when you do it. And Jesus says, oh, you have no clue, Peter. You have no idea what you're talking about. Jesus says, listen, in my kingdom, amongst my people, those who are part of this kingdom that I'm establishing in this world, they're going to know mercy in their soul. And forgiveness is just automatic in their hearts and in their minds because the God of mercy has made them into creatures ontologically merciful. So no, this is not a picture of God retracting his mercy from a people. That's missing the point. That's exactly the opposite of the point. The point of the message is, Peter, you need to start thinking differently about what it means to be a part of my kingdom. You're thinking in terms of obligations and regulations and rules and how we're going to do things and how often we're going to do it and how well we're going to do it, and you have missed the point. Can an unregenerate man understand what I just said? Can an unregenerate man understand what I just said? No! That's why it's a parable. It cannot be understood by unregenerate men. And it has nothing to do with unregenerate men. It has to do with what the kingdom is going to look like. See? So you see, this question is a great question because it forces us to stop and think about what we're reading exegetically, hermeneutically. It makes us think about the reality of the soteriology around us. What is Jesus actually trying to say in context to what Peter is trying to ask him and so forth? It's about us. It's a perfect question, and I really appreciate the question because it's a perfect opportunity for me to end this Ask the Pastor by saying, listen, I know that you have lots and lots and lots of questions about things. But the mistake that we often make is we have a tendency to think, as material beings crushed by the curse, that it's all about our behavior and our successes and how well we do this or that. And what this parable does is it drives a stake into that by Jesus saying, look, wait, no. You're missing the point. The point is, live as a regenerate man. That's what you're going to do. That's what you're supposed to do. That's what it means to be a Christian. That's what it means to be part of the kingdom of heaven. If you think that heaven, that supposed place we're all going to go at some point, if you think that's going to be a place filled with rules and regulations about how often we're supposed to forgive each other, you've missed the point. And guess what? You've missed the kingdom. You're not in it. The man who is in that kingdom says, my performance isn't the standard. My nature is the standard. Now, I realize what I just said to you is extraordinarily difficult to get your arms around. It takes years to figure out what I'm talking about. But that's why we have Scripture to teach us these things. That's why we have the Lord Himself teaching us these things. It's about what we are. It's not about what we do. And in fact, if I can connect this back to the first question again, we celebrate Christmas not because it's a good time to give gifts or a wonderful holiday season or nostalgia that overruns us. We don't know. That's not why. Here's why. Because the God who is merciful and loving and righteous and holy came into this world as all of those things to make us that. If you really want to get technical, Christmas is a time for us to celebrate the fact that God has made us righteous. That God has made us holy. Time's up. God has made us holy. God has made us righteous. God has made us merciful. These are the things that God has put into the new nature in us. We celebrate His coming to bring that to us. So, to you who gave me this question, I am deeply grateful because it is a perfect way to end this time of Ask the Pastor. If I could accomplish anything at all in a pastoral ministry called Ask the Pastor, it would be to land here. To say, hey folks, be what God has made you to be. Be what God has made you to be.